This is Samuel's Persiflage, episode number 5 for May 2006. Hello and welcome to another episode of Samuel's Persiflage, coming to you from the lovely city of Canberra. Well, today on the show we've got a fair bit coming up for you. We've got another Persiflage puzzle. I must say there was an interesting reaction to the last Persiflage puzzle, and I'll go through that in the feedback, which comes up a little bit later on. There's also a bit of a change to how you can send feedback. Just so that it makes it just a little bit easier. Today, though, we have the major feature of the show is an interview with Margaret Phillips, the Director of Digital Archiving at the National Library of Australia. She'll be talking to us about a number of things that the library does, including, and this is something I'm very excited about, the Pandora Archive, which is their attempt at archiving the Australian internet web space, basically. So we'll go into that one. That's quite interesting. That'll take up most of the show. We've also got some odd stories, and as I mentioned, we do have the feedback and the Persiflage puzzle, so I think it's going to be a good show. I hope you can stick around for it. I don't know if saying that you should stay tuned is the right term to use in a podcast, but we might use it anyway. I hope you can stay tuned to Samuel's Persiflage. But before we can do anything else, we better introduce the Persiflage puzzle, and it's an interesting one this month. There's a few words in this one, and I'll give you a little clue. This one is probably one of the more well-recognized music combinations of our history. I won't say much more than that, except to say that they're fairly influential, at least they were. I won't go any further than that, but I'll let you think about that. Anyway, there are 5 words. The first word has 4 letters. The second word has 5 letters. The third word has 3 letters. The fourth word also has 3 letters. And the last word has 6 letters. And seeing as we're on our first go at the Persiflage puzzle for this month, I'll give you 5 letters. Let's start with the letter K. And there are none of those there. So we might try the letter W and... none of those either. Let's have a look. Next one is the letter F for Fred. None of them. So that's no K's, no W's, no F's. Let's pull out another letter, and it's the letter N for neighbour. And that's in the puzzle. It's the second letter of the third word. So the second letter of the third word is an N. And the next letter out is the letter Z for zebra. None of them. So that's a few letters, and the letters that aren't in there, they might help you work it out as well, because the letters that aren't in there help you eliminate some of the possibilities. The National Library of Australia is one of Australia's more important institutions, but one that not a lot of people seem to understand properly. Joining me on the line to talk about the National Library is their Director of Digital Archiving, Margaret Phillips. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Samuel.
So, in a nutshell, what is the role of the National Library?
The role of the National Library is to collect and preserve Australia's documentary heritage. That's the primary role. We also collect material from overseas, particularly that material which gives context to the Australian collections. An important area of our overseas collecting is from Southeast Asia and the Pacific, for instance,
right,
because of Australia's role and geographic placement in that area.
Mm-hmm.
That's our fundamental role. And then, of course, there are related activities such as providing researchers, readers, members of the public with access to those collections. So we have, of course, information services.
Right.
We have exhibitions, including some travelling exhibitions which go around Australia so that Australians, wherever they are, can gain access to our collections and the information contained within them.
Right. I've met a few people who seem to get the impression that it's just a really big version of a suburban library, but that's not true because you can't actually borrow the materials, can you?
It's not true. Well, the materials can be borrowed, but not in the same way as your local public library. The National Library is much more than a public library. We have other roles which include setting up information infrastructure within Australia for all Australian libraries to use. That includes the service that's recently been launched called Libraries Australia.
Right.
And that is a service which enables people wherever they are, at home, at school, in their office, to search what is called the National Bibliographic Database. The National Bibliographic Database is a collection of catalogue records or descriptions of library resources that I think it's somewhere like 800 libraries around Australia have in their collections. So all of the local public libraries, the university libraries, the special libraries such as libraries at hospitals, the state libraries, they all catalogue or describe the materials that they have in their collections, and then they contribute it. They send those records to the National Bibliographic Database, and the National Library makes those available to everybody to search through this new service called Libraries Australia. Now, that assists people, wherever they are, to locate a book or a serial or a picture, a manuscript, a map that may help them with their research. And it gives them information about how they can then obtain access to that information. And that includes services such as what librarians call document supply, so they can go to their local public library and request that library to borrow that book or obtain a copy of a journal article, for instance, from another library somewhere in the country that actually holds that item. And that would include from the National Library. So the National Library does lend its some of its collection materials to other libraries upon request.
Okay.
But no, you can't walk into the National Library and just borrow a book over the counter.
Hmm. The National Library keeps on record it's one copy of each book published in Australia, isn't it?
That's correct. That is enabled through the legal deposit legislation, which is part of the Copyright Act of 1968. That Act stipulates that all publishers should send one copy of everything they publish to the National Library, and that enables the National Library to build a preservation collection of everything that's published in print in Australia. Unfortunately, that legislation has not yet been extended to include other formats, such as CD-ROMs, DVDs, or web publications. And that means that the library does experience some difficulty in building up a comprehensive collection of those kinds of materials. But we are attempting to do that without the aid of legal deposits.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your Internet Archive project a little bit later on. But regular listeners would remember Gary Floyd, a school librarian from an earlier episode. I was chatting with him probably a week or two ago, and he made an interesting point about Screen Sound Australia collecting audio and video, and the National Library doing that as well. And he asked me if I could ask you where you sort of draw the boundary between the two institutions.
The National Library and Screen Sound Australia, which has now gone back to its former name of the National Film and Sound Archive.
Oh, has it? I can never keep up with that. They keep changing it.
Yes, they've changed back to the former name. Have complementary roles. The collection at the National Film and Sound Archive used to be part of the National Library until those two collections were separated out, but we're still in very close contact over our collection policies, and we don't duplicate each other. We have defined collection policies. The National Library's collection in this area is oral history recordings and also folklore recordings.
Right.
Our recordings, by and large, are not commercial recordings. They're recordings that we commission, that we engage either our staff or our experts in the field to interview Australians of importance in some aspect of Australian life. And we record those interviews and create transcripts of them and add them to our collections. Likewise, we engage people with particular expertise to go out into various communities and to create folklore recordings.
Mm-hmm.
The National Film and Sound Archive, on the other hand, is responsible for collecting the commercial audio and video recordings that are produced in Australia. So there's a very distinct difference between the collecting tasks of the two agencies. Sometimes we do have materials sent to us, a video or a DVD or a CD, something of that nature. And if it contains primarily music or film, we will send it on to Screen Sound. But if it contains some text and documentary material, some explanatory material, sometimes we do consider that it's more appropriate for our collection. So sometimes there is a bit of a grey area, but mostly it's fairly clear what the two organisations will collect.
Right. Well, going back to the books being added under the legal deposit part of the Copyright Act, what's the process for actually having a book added to your collection? The books obviously have to be sent, but do you get notified that a book is going to be published before it's published, or do they just turn up?
Sometimes we do have notification. The library also offers a service to publishers, which is called Cataloguing in Publication, or CIP as it's known for short. And publishers can ring the CIP section of the library and ask for what is known as it's a brief catalogue record based on the information that the publisher gives to the library officer over the phone. The librarian then catalogues the item and supplies that record to the publisher. And the publisher then publishes that or inserts that catalogue record into the front of the book. Now that alerts us to the fact that that book is on the way. But we don't always have that kind of advance notice, and we often receive books that from publishers, particularly the large amount of self-publishing that takes place now, the desktop publishing.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's not an essential part of the process, but it is a service that the library offers to publishers who want it. The library acquires books in a number of ways, through legal deposit, as I mentioned, but we also purchase copies of Australian books. When the books come in on legal deposit, we look at them and evaluate whether they're the kinds of publications that the library is likely to receive interlibrary loan requests for. And if they are, then we purchase a second copy from the publisher. We also publish books from overseas. We do that most often through blanket orders. So we have suppliers overseas to whom we give a selection profile. We tell them the sorts of books that we want to acquire, the subjects that we give emphasis to, and the audience that we're interested in, so mostly an adult research-oriented mm-hmm. audience. And then they send us books that meet that profile.
Right.
We also receive books on donation. Sometimes members of the public have in their personal collections books of value that they think the library might not hold and would be interested in. And we also purchase retrospective Australiana. So in the past, for some reason, we may have missed out on collecting published material, and we strive to fill those gaps.
Right. I suppose newspapers come under similar legislation. I'm not aware of the exact legislation there, but you keep copies of all of the newspapers or just some?
You're right. Newspapers, being printed library material, are subject to the legal deposit legislation.
Right.
And we do collect a comprehensive collection of Australian newspapers. The kinds of newspapers that we would not include would be very local newspapers. The kind of free newspapers that would be put on into your letterbox, for instance, for local areas. But the state libraries are responsible for collecting those kinds of local interest newspapers. So they are definitely collected within Australia. The National Library administers what is called the newspaper plan, the Australian Newspaper Plan, or NPLAN for short.
Mm-hmm.
And the national and state libraries are on the planning committee to ensure that all Australian newspapers are collected and preserved in at least one library. But the National Library acquires a comprehensive collection of Australian newspapers, and for many of them we also collect them in a microfilm version as well.
Right. So how do you decide which newspapers to put onto microfilm and which ones not to? I would imagine, based on how people come in to access the newspapers, that perhaps the ones that are more likely to be accessed would be put on microfilm to to save the original version?
That's exactly right. I mean, as you'd be aware, newspaper is a very easily torn. It's a low-grade quality, and it degrades fairly quickly with use. So it's the high-use newspapers that we acquire the microfilm for. Usually, we don't create that microfilm ourselves. The publishers supply a microfilm version, although we have to buy that. That doesn't come with legal deposit.
Oh, that's interesting.
We do have a microfilming project with some of the members of this newspaper preservation plan, and that is microfilming the older newspapers for which the commercial microfilm isn't available. We microfilm old newspapers as a preservation measure. And microfilm and also digitize so that they can be viewed online.
Oh, okay. Just going back to the local newspapers just for a moment, would it be fair to say that as well as being the National Library, you also fulfil the role of ACT State Library? Because you collect the Chronicle, which is a very Canberra-centric publication.
Yes.
And I suppose seeing as the ACT is such a small area, you probably fulfil that role as well?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that we do. I mean, it's unofficial, I think. The ACT has its own heritage library, and it is collecting important ACT materials of heritage value. But certainly when we select material here for the National Library's collection, we do take into account that the library building is situated in the ACT, and that the ACT government library system doesn't have quite the resources that we do, and so we do give more preference to ACT publications, including government publications and newspapers, than we would say for the other states.
Okay. Well, what we might do now, we've just got a few other quick things to do, so we'll come back to this in just a moment. But right now on Samuel's Persiflage.
Samuel's Persiflage is the feedback. Send your emails to podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com.
Yes, indeed, it's time for the Samuel's Persiflage listener feedback. And as you'd be well aware, you can send your feedback to podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com. Now, you can send written feedback. After all, that's what email was intended for. Or if you want, you can send some audio feedback. And I appreciate the audio feedback because, after all, this is an audio product, really. So having that audio feedback just breaks a bit of the monotony of me talking a lot. Now, you can attach that to an email quite easily, in MP3 format or WAV format or Ogg Vorbis format. I'm happy to receive any of those. Or there's an even easier way to do it now. I've added this for your convenience. On the podcast website, which is samuelgordonstewart.com/samuels-persiflage, or just go to samuelgordonstewart.com and click on the Samuel's Persiflage link, you'll find there's a button to send audio feedback. If you click on that, that will take you to another page, thanks to the people at odeo.com, where you can send through some spoken feedback. It'll record the feedback for you right there on the web page, and it will send it for you. You can attach a short and written message if you want. I will receive that. I can get that from the site in MP3 format and quite easily include it here on the podcast. So you've got all of these options open to you, and as much as I love getting the written feedback, it would just be great if I could also get some spoken and even musical feedback, if you like, because, as I said, it just helps to break the monotony of me speaking a lot. Anyway, it's on to the feedback, and Pete is first this month. He says, Samuel, I listened to this on the way to Sydney on Friday. He's talking about episode number 4. It certainly made the trip shorter, and I could only smile when you read my comments on the air. Thank you, Pete. Well, thank you very much, Pete. That's very nice of you, and I'm glad that I made your trip to Sydney much shorter. Chuck sends us an email. Hi, Samuel. How are you? I really enjoyed Samuel's Persiflage episode 4. I think you're really getting the hang of it now. My favourite part was the interview with Mrs. Gordon Stewart. I enjoy listening to people's stories who I don't know. I found it fascinating. You seemed very relaxed interviewing your mum. Have you been to the Netherlands? Well, Chuck, no, I haven't, although it would be nice to go sometimes. Chuck goes on to say, I sometimes listen to Radio Netherlands via news radio on the ABC. That's interesting. I can't say I've actually listened to it. I would assume that if it's on news radio, it's in English. I would hope it is, because it would be a bit hard to understand for most people in Australia if it wasn't. Chuck then goes on to say, your mum's story was very interesting. Please pass on my regards to her and thank her for her interview. I've already done that, Chuck, so thank you for that. She appreciated that. Chuck says, maybe Mr. Gordon Stewart could appear on the next Persiflage. Well, maybe. We'll see. He might appear sometime in the future, maybe. We'll see what happens. Chuck goes on. This is a lengthy email. Echuca is on the Victorian side of the border. Chuck's referring to an incident in the last episode during the interview with Mrs. Gordon Stewart. We'll just play that now.
Help with looking after her children.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt. I just found Echuca. It's on the Murray River. It's a bit north of the New South Wales-Victoria border, but carry on.
Apart from that,
Chuck goes on to write, if you cross the bridge at Echuca over the Murray River, you arrive at Moama. I used to go on holiday there. Well, Chuck, you're right. Echuca is in Victoria. See, what happened is, the map behind me in this studio, it shows railway lines and state lines, and unfortunately, it's not terribly clear, and the lines look very, very similar. And as I was in the middle of recording it, I sort of looked at the wrong line. Echuca was north of the railway line, which I realise now, but actually south of the state line, which I didn't see. So I mistakenly thought that Echuca was in New South Wales, which obviously it isn't. But not to worry, you're not the only one who told me that, Chuck. Plenty of people sent through emails about that, so thank you to everyone who highlighted that for me, and yes, these accidents will occur, it has to be said. Now, people who were listening to episode number 3 would remember Danny O'Brien from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Well, he sent through this email, hey Samuel, thanks so much for sending me the stats on the Persiflage appearance, but don't worry, there's no need to email this to me every month. If you want to let me know, feel free to just email it to me. Best wishes, Danny. Well, thank you very much for that, Danny. I've replied to that. See, my basic policy with all of the people who appear on the show is that I will send them letters, or in Danny's case now, emails, outlining how many downloads there have been of their episode of Samuel's Persiflage each month. And I send these through just after the beginning of the month, once all the stats have been collated and calculated. I print them out and I send them through with the total downloads so that they know how much has been heard. Much like I do with the blog view stats on the SamuelGordonStewart.com website. The Persiflage stats are indeed included there, and that's pretty much what I send through to the people who appear on the show, the stats for their episode. And overall, the response has been very good. I actually received a few letters from people who've been on the show previously thanking me for these letters. And Danny was really no exception there. But, yes, certainly printing them out and sending them by airmail is not only taking up some time, but it also means I'm using a lot of paper. So I am starting to send through some of them by email now, which is certainly easier. But I think it's important that I do send through these stats, because ultimately, with any broadcast medium such as radio or television, if you're on an interview there, you can quite easily find out roughly how many people are listening. But with podcasts, there's no easy way to do that. So what I do, I've decided that the best thing to do is to make sure that the people who appear on the show know roughly how many people have listened to their interview. Obviously, download statistics aren't exact listener statistics due to the very nature of downloads, but it's a rough estimate and it seems to work most of the time. So that's basically the policy there. Moving on, and Jerry poses a very interesting question. Samuel, why do you use podcast at samuelgordonstewart.com and not persiflage at samuelgordonstewart.com? The second one would make more sense. Well, Jerry, before I started the show in December last year, I was thinking the exact same thing. I might as well just use persiflage at samuelgordonstewart.com. But if you have a look through some of the sites that have actually linked to Samuel's persiflage, it'll become quite apparent that regardless of how often people see the word persiflage, they have no idea how to spell it. Now, I really don't know how many people send emails to the samuelgordonstewart.com domain to addresses that don't actually exist there, but the only way I could really capture all of the persiflage possible spellings is to either set up a few dozen email accounts and have them all forward to the one, which would be a pain in the neck, and in fact mean that I'd end up with more multiple bits of spam in the emails. Or I could just have all of the false emails just forward into there, and that would just be painful as well, as I'd end up spending hours trawling through all of these pointless emails, which would ultimately be caught by the spam filter for the most part. But I generally look through my spam, just a quick skim, to see if anything legitimate has been picked up by the spam filters. Usually it isn't, but it would just mean that process would take much longer. So podcast is a word, it's two syllables, it's very easy to spell, and most people can spell it, and if they can't, there's a link on the Samuel's Persiflage website, not only to podcast at samuelgordonstewart.com, but also to the spoken feedback link, which is very helpful as well. So if you'd like to send me some feedback, those two options are open to you, podcast at samuelgordonstewart.com, or you can send me some spoken feedback, rather, by clicking on that link on the site. I think we might do just a quick update on the persiflage puzzle before we go back to Margaret Phillips from the National Library of Australia. And we will draw out a few more letters for you. We'll start with the letter J for Jerry, and there are none of them. We seem to be having a run of letters that aren't in the puzzle. Okay, well, let's have a look at another letter. The letter O. Yes, that's in there. It's the second letter in the fifth word. So the second letter in the last word, indeed. All right, well, we'll go on and pull out another letter. How about the letter C for cat? Well, that one's in there as well. That's the first letter of the last word. And we'll have another letter now, the letter V for Victor. And it's not in the puzzle at all. So, well, keeping in mind that clue I gave you earlier, you might be able to work this out if you know your music, but I don't know, this one looks like it could be a bit tricky. We'll have another update a little bit later on.
You're listening to Samuel's Birds of Lounge.
Well, now it's back to Margaret Phillips, who is the Director of Digital Archiving at the National Library of Australia. And we might talk about one of your other projects, which is the Internet Archive Project, or Pandora, which is an acronym, but I seem to have misplaced the meaning of it at the moment. But as you were saying earlier, the newer technologies such as CD-ROMs and, in fact, web pages don't fall under the legal deposit legislation. So you've started the Pandora project to help archive some of the Australian websites.
That's correct, yes. This is an enterprise that's very dear to my heart. I've been working on it since 1996. We have our 10th anniversary this year. And
happy birthday.
Thank you.
My website just celebrated 1 year, so I've got a fair way to catch up here.
It's quite an achievement, we feel. In Pandora stands for Preserving and Accessing Networked Documentary Resources of Australia, and that's really our mission, I suppose, that gives rise to that acronym. In, well, late 1995 it was really, the collection managers at the National Library began to discuss the fact that there was a lot of material now appearing on the internet that wasn't also being published in print, so we weren't collecting it in the usual way. And we decided that we needed to do something about this, and we set up a small group to examine what kind of publications were appearing within the Australian web domain. And from that, we developed some selection guidelines. And then April of 1996, we set up a small unit of staff to start to select more of those publications, to catalogue them into the National Bibliographic Database. And then towards the end of that year, we also made some initial steps in actually archiving them. It was late 1997, I think, before there was actually an archive online, which members of the public could have a look at. But since then, we've gone from strength to strength, and we now have almost 11,500 Australian websites and web publications in the archive. Many of those titles have been archived multiple times. Many websites change over time, and we want to capture those significant changes. There are also quite a number of serial titles which add new issues every month or every quarter, and so we go back and capture that new content on a regular basis. And there are 22,000 of those recaptured, what we call instances. Every time we recapture a website, we call it a new instance. So there are 22,000 of those in the archive. So it's now quite a sizable body of information.
So how do you actually go about choosing websites to record in this way? Because obviously you can't just go and take the .au top-level domain. because there are plenty of websites that are from Australia, mine included for that matter, which don't use the .au domain. And I suppose that could very well be for cost reasons. I mean, hosting in the US, for example, is extremely cheap, and .com domain names are also extremely cheap. So a lot of the Australian web content is being hosted overseas. So how do you go about choosing the websites to archive?
The answer to that question is quite a complex one.
Okay.
I'll attempt to answer it. Firstly, we have the Selective Archive, which we've been working on for the last 10 years, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. But last year, we did, in fact, do a harvest of the .au domain. That was a major development in our work of archiving the Australian web domain. We went to the Internet Archive, which is a non-profit organisation in San Francisco in the US.
Mm-hmm.
They create, I don't know whether you or your listeners would have heard of the Internet Archive. They actually go out and attempt to archive the whole web every 2 months. And so they have been doing a top slice, if you like, of the Australian domain, but they haven't been concentrating on, they haven't allowed enough time for the Australian domain to do it to any depth. So we decided that we would do just that. We would contract the Internet Archive to run their crawlers over the .au domain for a period of 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so they brought us back a lot of material, 185 million unique files. So we have in fact attempted that. As part of that crawl, which took place in June and July of last year, the Internet Archive tried out some new technology which would attempt to pick up at least some of the Australian material without the .au.
Mm-hmm.
It did this by, when it was looking at an Australian site, like a .au site, if there were links out to a site that was not .au, it went to a lookup table to see if that IP address was registered as being Australian. And if it was, it would also collect that. So using that technique, we have picked up a proportion, we don't know what proportion, but at least some are websites without the .au suffix.
Right.
So getting back to the Selective Archive, we have a team of five staff whose job it is to identify and select publications from the Australian web domain. Including those interpreted broadly, including those without the .au at the end.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, your own site is included in the archive.
Yes.
And they then go through the process of contacting the publisher for permission to archive, scheduling the harvest using the Pandora Digital Archiving System that has been developed in-house by the National Library. And then once it's been harvested, they do the quality checking work to make sure that the item is complete and functional. They catalogue the item into the National Bibliographic Database, and then they make it available in the public archive so members of the public can gain access to it.
Hmm. I remember it would have been, I'm just trying to remember now, it was early this year from memory that my site was archived. And I remember once I gave permission for it to be archived and I had a look at the result of the archiving work, I was amazed that it is really a carbon copy of what you see on the web. It's has all the images there, it has all the original formatting. So not only are you preserving the textual content of it, but you're also preserving the style of the time as well.
That's correct. That's what we're attempting to do. It's what we call collecting the content and also what we call the look and feel. And we give quite a lot of emphasis to that aspect of it with the selective archive. The big advantage with the selective archive, even though we can do only a very small proportion of Australian web publications in this labour-intensive way, is that we do the quality checking to make sure that it's all there. And because we have the publisher's permission, we can also provide access to it immediately. Because that legal deposit legislation does not yet cover online publications, we can't give access to it without the publisher's permission.
Right.
So this the whole domain harvest that we've done, we can't guarantee that the items that we've collected there, the web resources, will be complete or functional, and for the time being, we also can't provide access to them.
Mm-hmm.
But we felt that it was important for the future, for research purposes into the future, that we at least collect it and keep it.
Yes. The PANDAS system that you use to archive all of these websites is in itself, I'm led to believe, quite an amazing piece of technology. Without going into the nitty-gritty of how it works, would you like to give an overview of it?
Yes, I can do that. The library developed this software because when the archive began to be of a size that was hard to manage, we needed some software to manage the various work processes that are involved. So we needed to register a publication, so enter the details about its the title, its web address. We needed to record information that supported the work processes, such as the publisher's name, whether or not they'd given us permission, any restrictions on access that needed to be applied that the publisher had asked for. And then we needed that to interface with the harvester, the gatherer. What we preferred to do was to go out into the marketplace and buy some software, but this was such a new activity at the time that it hadn't, the commercial software providers hadn't seen a ready market for it, so it just wasn't there. We had to develop it ourselves.
Well, to the same extent, a lot of the search engines have developed their systems themselves as well, and they don't do the same job, but they do a similar job in that they gather a lot of the information from the websites and organise it so that when people type something into the search engine, it can return relevant results. And Google, for example, have their own very unique systems which they developed. So to that extent, you're not too dissimilar to the search engines. You've developed your own system that works the way you need it to work.
That's exactly correct, yes. The other need that we had was to be able to support the other libraries that participate in the Pandora Archive. The National Library is the coordinator and we provide the technical infrastructure, but all of the mainland state libraries and the Northern Territory Library, as well as the National Film and Sound Archive, the Australian War Memorial, and the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies, all select web publications according to their own selection criteria, and they use the Panda software to put those into the Pandora archive. So we needed software that would enable these other participating libraries to contribute remotely. It's web-based software. And we've had some expressions of interest from other libraries around the world. For instance, the United Kingdom Web Archiving Consortium, which includes the British Library, the National Archives of the UK, and some of the main university libraries, formed a consortium to do exactly this same kind of work that we've been doing in Australia, and they asked us if they could use our software, which they have been doing. The National Library Board of Singapore is also interested in using our software. So it has filled a gap that other libraries have experienced as well.
Yes. Now, I could go on talking about this all day because it's absolutely fascinating, but I will wrap it up here just with this question. How do you foresee the Pandora project evolving over the next, say, 10 to 20 years? It's a bit of a long-range question, I know, but I suppose I'll narrow it down. Just how do you see this going forward? What do you think is in the future for Pandora?
In the area of the web and information technology, it's very hard to see even 10 years ahead. Perhaps I'll talk in terms of the next 5 years.
That's reasonable.
I would see us developing our understanding and expertise of whole domain harvesting. We're planning another whole domain harvest later this year so that we can hone our skills and our expertise in that area. I would hope within the next 5 years that we will get legal deposit for online publications. The library has certainly been lobbying our parent department, the Department of Communications, Information Technology and the Arts, and Attorney General to help us to obtain the extension to legal deposit that we need. And if that is the case, then the whole domain harvest, I would foresee, will become a more important aspect of our work, because we will then be able to give access to that material. I would expect that we will still continue to do the selective archiving that we're currently doing, but we will do less of that, and we will concentrate more just on the key nationally significant Australian publications, and rely on the whole domain harvest for the wider range of websites, organisational websites, community websites, that sort of thing. So in the future, I would anticipate that we'll see a blending of these two archiving techniques that we've engaged in, and with a development of the whole domain harvesting.
Right. Just on the legal deposit thing, if the legal deposits were extended to the websites, would that mean that web publishers would need to notify you that they do have an Australian-based website, or would you work that out yourselves? I just ask because if web publishers did have to notify you of it, I can just foresee an awful lot of web publishers not notifying you, and probably not realising they're breaking the law by doing such.
That's right. We foresee the same thing. And what we have asked for in the legal deposit legislation for online materials is not that the publishers need to notify us, but simply that we have permission to go out and harvest the material that we want from their site. And this would only be for the freely available material.
Mm.
We wouldn't be able to harvest the commercial material in that way because there are usually passwords or other mechanisms which prevent people gaining access without paying, and those mechanisms would prevent our harvester harvesting the material anyway. So with the commercial material, we would still need to approach the publishers and ask for their permission and their cooperation. So this would relate only to the freely available material.
All righty then. Well, it's hard to believe this, but we've been talking for nearly 40 minutes here, so it's probably a good time to wrap up. How can people find out more about Pandora and the National Library?
People can find out more about both by going to the National Library's website, which is www.nla.gov.au.
Right, I'll include a link to that in the show notes as well.
Okay, and down the bottom of the National Library's webpage, there is a logo, the Pandora logo, and anyone who's interested can go into the archive by following that link.
Mm. And whilst they're there, they can look through information about Pandora, and they can also have a look at the websites that you've archived and made publicly available.
Indeed they can.
Mm. Much like on your main website, the nla.gov.au one, they can also browse through your catalogue as well.
They can. They can gain access to the library's own catalogue. They can gain access to the Libraries Australia service, which I mentioned earlier, which will give them access to 800 Australian libraries catalogues and many other information sources and services that are available at the National Library, including how to contact National Library staff if they want assistance in locating information. It's all there on that site.
Right. Well, Margaret, it's been fascinating talking to you. I've been planning to talk to someone from the National Library for quite a while, and I'm very glad that I got to talk to you, because being the Director of Digital Archiving, you know about Pandora, you have a very intimate knowledge of Pandora, and obviously with my website being part of the Pandora Archive, it's something that's close to my heart as well. So, Margaret, thank you very much for your time, and thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you, Samuel, for the opportunity to talk about the library, and in particular Pandora.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Samuel's Persiflage.
All right, well, we'll have another look at the Persiflage puzzle now. And it was interesting last month, the feedback I got about the Persiflage puzzle, where most of it was good. A lot of people seemed to think that it was a good way to keep people listening and engaged throughout the show. And, you know, I'd have to agree with them, because ultimately, before we had the Persiflage puzzle in here, I thought the show was going pretty well, but it really didn't seem to have much of a purpose. It was just me sitting here talking to people a bit. But the show sort of has a little bit more of its own unique feel, I think, now, just because there is something there for you as a listener to do other than just listen. You can quite easily play along a bit if you want, and it's just a bit of extra fun, I think, it adds into the show. But, well, speaking of the puzzle, I think we should probably reveal a few more letters. So, let's see about pulling out a few more letters, shall we? Well, we've got the letter R for rabbit, and it's another one of those letters that just doesn't appear in the puzzle. This is becoming a bit of a problem, I think. We can eliminate a lot of letters, but it would also help to see what's in the puzzle and where it is. So, let's see what we can pull out this time. And It's the letter B for Bill. And, well, that's in there, isn't it? It's the first letter of the first word, in fact. That's a B. And we'll draw out another letter. It's the letter T for Tom. And that's, there are two of them. It's the first letter of the fourth word and the fifth letter of the fifth word. So, have a think about that. As I said, they were a fairly influential musical group. I won't say much more because if you think about it for long enough, you should get this one. Assuming you know your music, so we'll see how we go with that one. The answer will be revealed a little bit later on. It's odd news story time. That's one of the more interesting parts of the podcast, I suppose, although I think it's all interesting, so maybe you have a different opinion, but this is certainly one of my favourite parts of the podcast. Now, you might recall last year there was a news story floating about, which was to do with self-heating cans of coffee. You'd walk into a store, you'd buy this can of coffee, and it had some sort of chemical concoction in it that heated the can of coffee. Well, they're being recalled. It seems that some of them didn't heat adequately, and others, they just kept heating, and they exploded and melted through the packaging. I really don't think I'd want to be holding one when it did that. But thankfully they've been recalled, so whether there'll be a fix for it or not, I don't know. This is a very unusual one. A survey of close to 7,000 women aged 20 years or older shows that snoring is most common among women in their 50s, and the heavier a woman is, the more likely she is to snore. Now, it seems that this survey also thinks that the more you smoke, or the wider your neck is, and it seems that there's even a link here to high blood pressure and stroke. The higher chance you have of that, or the heavier you are, or the wider your neck is, the more likely you are to snore. Now, this was all in aid of trying to work out why people get sleep apnea and how it can be fixed. Well, I think they may be on the track to solving that one. Now, here's another story that seems to say, what if you could turn your spouse's snoring into nothing more than background noise? It may seem impossible, especially if you've lived with it for years. However, some claim there's a way you can get that much-needed sleep. It seems that using hypnosis, you can't stop a person from snoring by hypnotizing them and turning them into a chicken, but you can apparently make other people think that the snoring is a different sound. So I suppose the classic tale of sleeping bliss and people's imaginations is being on a deserted island in the tropics with the waves crashing onto the beach. And so I suppose the theory is here that the hypnotists will just make you think that your partner's snoring is in fact waves on a beach. Well, I don't know. Would that work? The hypnotists certainly think it would, but I don't know, it seems a little bit strange to me. Signals from mobile phone masts have been used to measure rainfall patterns in Israel. A team from the University of Tel Aviv analyzed information routinely collected by mobile networks to make their estimates. Writing in the journal called Science, the researchers say their technique is more accurate than current methods used by meteorological services. Similar work has been done by scientists in the UK. Now, it seems that what happens here is that when it's raining, the mobile phone signals don't go through strongly enough, so the systems that the mobile phone carriers use just increase the power of the signal automatically and decrease it when it doesn't need to be as strong because it's not raining. And it seems that using this data, the scientists can work out how much rain there is. Apparently, they can do something similar with GPS signals. So that's an interesting one. Although one does have to wonder what happened to the humble weather radars. I can go onto the Australian Bureau of Meteorology's website and see the latest radar images and animations of the last few radar images and see where the rain's coming from and how long it'll probably be until it's here. So I think I'd rather use that, actually, because that actually tells me where the rain is, not just how much there is, which, of course, the radar tells me as well. According to EE Times, an Israeli company has developed a personal video display device that looks like a simple pair of glasses. You can use these glasses with various sources, such as a portable media player or your cell phone. Well, why? I'm just thinking about this. If you're on public transport, for example, and you're wearing headphones to listen to music or even a podcast, such as Samuel's Persiflage, that's not too bad, because if you've got it to the volume down low enough, you can hear your surroundings and you can still see your surroundings quite easily. Now, if you have video glasses on and you're watching something, well, you're going to need the sound as well, so you're going to have the earphones. So not only are you eliminating most background noise, so eliminating the noise from your surroundings, you're also eliminating the visuals of your surroundings. So not only can you not hear what's going on around you, you can't see what's going on around you. So to start with, I don't know how you're going to see your stop if you're on the bus or the train. And I certainly don't know how this is going to work in terms of personal safety, because you will occasionally get unscrupulous people on public transport or just in general day-to-day out in public. And I don't think I'd really want to be blocking out my surroundings with those people around. I mean, some people would, but not me. I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are on that one. And if you've got an unusual news story for me to take a look at, podcast at samuelgordonstewart.com is the email address. Well, here's a quick thought for you for the month. Why is it that we refer to an alarm clock as going off when in fact it's turning on? There's that music again. That must mean it's time for us to go. Well, before we do that, let's just see how you went with the persiflage puzzle. Well, it was Bill Haley and the Comets. Now, I've been doing a little bit of research, and for some reason, some people seem to refer to them as Bill Haley and his Comets. So there's two different names there, so if that threw you off, I apologise for that, but I've always known them as Bill Haley and the Comets, so hopefully you got it anyway. But that's the show for this month. I hope you enjoy it. No, I did, but that's fairly redundant for me to say that, isn't it? Because of course I'm going to enjoy it. That's what I do. I enjoy doing the show. And if you have any feedback, well, there's the two options, podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com or the spoken feedback, which is quite simply you can go to the Persiflage website and click on the button which says send spoken feedback, or I might say send audio feedback. And if you don't know where the website is and you're using iTunes, then you can actually find your way through to the website from the Samuel's Persiflage iTunes listing. So, by the way, I hope I can hear from you and get your feedback on the air next month, but until then, have a good month. I'll see you then. Ta-da!